Tales from the Vault is a production of the NFL in partnership with iHeartRadio. I'm Pro Football Hall of Fame journalist Andrea Kramer, and welcome to NFL Films Tales from the Vault. This is a weekly podcast where you'll get to hear raw, unedited conversations that have never been heard before in their entirety between the legendary Steve Sable and some of the greatest players and coaches in NFL history. This show, it's like a time capsule. It takes you back to a specific period in a player or coach's career. Now, Steve interviewed hundreds of the game's most important figures in his five decades as head of NFL Films. And as you'll hear, he would ask them anything. So today, we head to Mississippi, where Steve met up with a then 26-year-old Brett Favre. On July 1st, 1996, Steve Sable traveled to Kill, Mississippi. Current population, 2,319. To interview Brett Favre for the first time. At this point in his career, Favre had just completed his fourth season in Green Bay. He was coming off the first of three consecutive MVP awards, yet he still hadn't won the Super Bowl. He was young, electric, and personified fun, both as a person and in his playing style. Everyone wanted to get to know him. That's so hard to imagine now, knowing everything we do about Brett. I mean, he basically grew up so much in the public eye with his private life on display for everyone. We learned about his painkiller addiction, his wife Deanna's breast cancer, and our hearts broke when we learned about the death of his beloved father, Irv, and we cheered for Brett when he had the game of his life that night against the Raiders. When Steve went to visit Brett in his hometown, he really wanted to get to know Mississippi Brett, where he came from, his roots, his family. All of Favre's idiosyncrasies just fascinated Steve, and he needed to immerse himself in Brett's world to fully grasp it. Now, before we dig into the vault, you gotta let me set the scene for you. So, picture Steve Sable sitting alongside Brett Favre on a dock with a muddy body of water behind them, both wearing shorts and white polo shirts. Now, don't forget, this is home to Brett Favre, but certainly not for Steve Sable.
Well, they have snakes up in here.
Well, they have snakes here?
Full of them.
Where we're sitting, there's snakes.
Oh, yeah.
So, what kind of snakes?
Moccasin.
Well, those things are poisonous, too, aren't they?
Yeah, they won't hurt you too bad.
Did you ever get bit by one of them?
No, but my younger brother's friend's daughter got bit last week.
Here? By a snake?
No, but somewhere around here.
Now, where are we? If I was going to say, where are we located, what's the name of the place we're in?
We're in Hancock County, which is the county right next to Louisiana, on the bottom left-hand corner of Mississippi. And this is called Rotten Bayou, which is like a little
creek. We're sitting on the dock of the bay by Rotten Bayou?
Yeah.
Well, how did it get that name? I'm afraid to ask.
I'm not exactly sure. I guess a lot of dirty diapers and trash has been thrown in here. I don't know.
But your dad says you fish here.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you catch?
Catch bass, perch, catfish.
Do you know how to cook it?
Sure.
So you can skin it and everything?
Yeah, fillet it and cook it up. Yeah, it's good.
Really?
Alligators, gars,
so
turtles.
So there's alligators in here too, right?
You're down south, Steve. New Jersey.
Listen, no, I know. This is so backwoods. I turned on the TV last night, and they got Beverly Hillbillies on PBS. So I know I'm backwoods back here.
Absolutely.
But, you know, everybody here, Brett's got a funny way of talking. Like, this is Kill, right?
Kill.
But it's spelled
K-I-L-N.
Now, and your name, too, is pronounced Favre, but it's spelled
F-A-V-R-E.
Now, what is that? Is that like just a peculiarity of this area, or?
I think so. There are some Favres down here who spell their name F-A-R-V-E. My grandfather on my dad's side is full-blooded Indian. I don't know if that has anything to do with it. And then my mother's side is kind of a French Cajun a little bit.
Yeah.
So there is obviously.
Your mom told me that her dad ran a tavern here. His name was Benny French.
Sure did for years, and Hurricane Camille had wiped it out and redid it, and eventually sold it off to my uncle.
Now the road that we drove up on is an old dirt road to this house. Now, what happens when it rains? I mean, how the hell do you get in here?
Well, you just don't wash your car for a while. Because it does get tough. I can remember in growing up that most of the roads around here were all dirt.
Yeah.
And trying to get to school on a rainy day was almost impossible. So they would cancel certain days of school because of, like up north, you know, if it snows, they'll cancel school if it's bad enough. Well, down here, if it rains bad enough that the roads are flooded and it's dirt, then you can forget it. So we always prayed for rain.
The road here is named the Irvin
Farm Road, right.
But it's not spelled right.
Well, they spelled it F-A-R-V-E.
So how come nobody, you know, if you have a road named after you, you'd think that your dad would have gone out there and at least corrected the spelling.
Well, you know what? We've had the sign either stolen or shot at so many times.
Shot at?
Yeah. A mailbox. We used to go down and grab mail, and the mailbox would either be bent or it'd be gone. Sometimes we'd open up and there'd be firecrackers that had been popped in it. You know, there's a lot of people around here who are proud of the things I've done.
So they shoot at your mailbox?
Yeah.
That's a way of showing that they're proud of?
Well, there are some who are jealous, but that's a rarity. But for the most part, the people here are very proud and kind of stick up for me in all areas.
And your family's been in this area your whole life, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for like 30 years that you lived here.
I was born and raised right here.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the people down here, you got a lot of funny expressions that you use. Now, I remember we mic'd you for a game, and you're warming up, and you pick up the ball, and you're going like this, and you say, "This ball's slicker than owl shit." Now, how do you know how slick that is?
Well, you just got to grow up, you know, in this type of environment. You know, I've been to New Jersey and seen where you hang out. And to me, that's different. You know, my mother last night told me, "Well, if Steve and these guys are coming down, we got to make sure we have them something that they can relate to eat." And I said, "Well, hey, when I go to New Jersey, I don't ask for crawfish etouffee. I said, I eat what they have." So it's kind of like the area. You know, you go and
so
kind of blend in.
Your mom's going to have a cheesesteak for all the guys?
I doubt it. Very seriously. Red beans and rice is on Monday.
Yeah.
But we do have a lot of expressions. And you grow up in the country, you hear all those things, and then you start putting them together, and then you take them off with you.
If I was going to say somebody is really stupid, what would be an expression that you use down here? You know, I heard your dad say something earlier. We were talking. He says this guy was dumber than a bag of hammers. Now, is that?
or dumber than a bag of rocks. You know, I think there's so many. You know, but I've kind of been away for so long, and I think when I first got to Green Bay, Mike Holmgren said, "Look, I can't understand this guy," so I started working on my English a little bit and some of my sayings so he could relate to me. But we've kind of met in the middle a little bit. Yeah.
Your mom said she sent him a book of Mississippi expressions.
She did.
She
did.
And another one I heard you talk about, you were saying it was a running back, and you said that he is slower than the steam off horse manure. Now, is there any... Well, how about if you're talking about somebody who's really fast? Is there an expression that you use for that?
You know. Oh, God, I don't know. See, you put me on the spot right now. They have to just kind of come spontaneous.
All right, well, I was just wondering if there's any other of those kind of expressions.
You probably know more of what I've said than I know.
Yeah, well, and I know all your favorite songs, too.
That's right, that's right. I got to forget that you're Mike Miller.
Woo! Yeah, I love it. Can you believe they passed, Bart?
That was you hit me. I thought you hit harder than that.
Boy, I could sure use a hot dog with chili.
We can't catch a damn cold.
I don't even stretch anymore when I come out here. You think God never farted?
Few people were as entertaining as Brett Favre, but I can say that about him in real life, too. And by the way, over the time that I spent with him, fart jokes and references were commonplace. And occasionally, that's right, you'd get to witness one in the flesh. Very special. Let's move on here. He really had a mischievous streak. No one pulled pranks like Brett Favre. One of the most devious pranks that I can recall involved freezing teammates' car doors shut in the winter. So picture this. Favre would move the unlocked cars to the far end of the team parking lot in Green Bay. He would blast the air conditioner and pour water on the door so they couldn't get in. His Packers teammates would have a long trek through the windy parking lot to find their cars sealed shut from the ice. Now, naturally, this kind of behavior, if you will, dates back to his youth and would occasionally put him in the crosshairs of his coach, who just happened to be his father.
All right, now, when you were a kid, did you get in trouble a lot?
I don't know, compared to other kids, probably, yeah.
Yeah, what? Yeah, you were, you did get in trouble, or you
yeah,
were
really? Well, yeah, if you want to call it trouble. I was pretty mischievous, and always, I was telling my older brother yesterday, we went up to the old high school and was throwing the football a little bit, and when we were little, we'd be at the same school, and as my dad was practicing after school,
your dad was a coach, right?
High school football coach. We would go sneak into the cafeteria and steal milk. Yeah, just because we could do it. Yeah. You know, it was
did
no
you
big
steal
deal.
It just to steal it, or you drink it?
No, we would drink it. Yeah. You know, we'd steal two or three cartons, and it was 10 cents a carton. Yeah. You know, and we'd drink the milk, and then we'd go over, and then while my dad was practicing, we'd sneak in the locker room, we'd steal Gatorade, or we'd steal his jocks and socks and all this stuff because we wanted to be like the grown-ups. So we'd have this stuff, and we'd have it in our drawers here, and then, you know, on Sundays after pro football games, we'd put them on and go out and play.
Now, when you were a kid growing up, were you a big pro football fan?
Sure.
Yeah.
Who's
your favorite player?
Probably Archie Manning. Yeah. We grew up, as you can tell, in an area where we only got three channels. Mm-hmm. So it was ABC, NBC, and CBS. And the only game we could get was the Saints. Mm-hmm. And
those are the years the Saints were winning like one game.
At the most.
Most.
You know, a lot of brown paper bags were sold in this area. But, you know, it was fun watching them. And every year you just knew that they were going to the Super Bowl that year and they'd win two or three games. But it was a lot of fun. And Archie was a great player. You know, unfortunately, he didn't get to play with a great team.
Now, your dad was a football coach. And he's nicknamed the Hammer?
That one of numerous
and
nicknames.
Butch, right?
That's Butch. A, yeah.
Was he tough to play for?
Yeah, no. I tell people I was very fortunate to get a chance to play for him because I got a little extra. You know, when other guys went home after practice and didn't talk football until the next afternoon, and we talked it on the ride home when we woke up in the morning, at supper at night, before we went to bed, we were always talking football. And for me, you know, for some kids maybe that's too much, but for me I enjoyed it. And there were times during practice and during games where we kind of butted heads a little bit, kind of like me and Mike do now.
That's normal, though, with a quarterback and a coach, though. That's
it
not
is.
A big
you thing. Know, the quarterback tends to think he knows everything, and the head coach tends to think he knows everything. So there is some conflict there, but I think in the long run, if you're able to work it out, then you can use it to your advantage.
Now, when you went to high school here, were you a quarterback or a linebacker or running back or what?
Quarterback, played strong safety and punted and kicked and did just about everything. Yeah.
Did you get a scholarship to college?
Southern Mississippi. I think 2 days before the signing date, college signing date, our offensive line coach at Southern Miss gave me a call and said the guy that they had wanted backed out and went to a school in Florida. That now they had an opening for me. Did I want to take it? And I said, sure, because I was going to a junior college here in South Mississippi. So I was very fortunate.
But I was in that room, and you got so many trophies and stuff in there. You'd think that you would have been more recruited than that. That you know, you had a couple of these big schools after you, unless the caliber of football here isn't that good. I mean, how come all those, you got a whole trophy case of MVPs and stuff?
Mm-hmm. The caliber of football in South Mississippi is very good, but we're a smaller school. You got teams like Pascagoula, where Terrell Buckley and Shane Matthews.
What's the name of that schooling?
Pascagoula, which is it's probably a 1,500 student high school, where we were like 350. Mm-hmm. And then there's Gulfport High School that put out basketball players like Chris Jackson.
But you were like all league, and you must have been.
Sure,
all,
I was, but it was.
So it's still surprising you wouldn't get a an offer from Alabama.
Well, I got
or
a bunch
Miss
of letters.
Or, yeah. No, it's just like
just a bunch of letters. You know, I piled letters up and said, you know, this is great. But when it came time to offering scholarships, I guess they said, look, you know, your dad didn't throw the ball very much on your high school team. I think my senior year I threw for 400 yards. So we don't know if you can throw or not. You know, you got a strong arm, but whether or not you can, you know, you can do it on a college level, we don't know. And I can see where they were coming from, but, you know, we won. And the bottom line was winning, and I don't think Dad really cared whether – you know, we threw and won, or we ran and won.
What was your favorite subject in school?
Math.
Really?
Yeah.
That was that was the subject you looked forward to going to?
I won't say I looked forward to it. I never looked forward to going to school, period. But since I had to go, math was the 1 hour I could get through pretty easy.
Now, your mom tells me that you never studied, you never brought home books, mm-hmm. But you always had good grades.
Yeah.
How'd you do that?
Well, I always felt like when I left school that now it was time to, you know, to play.
Yeah.
So I said, heck, I'll do all my homework at school. I'll study at school. I'll
listen to class. Well, you must have paid attention in class.
Yeah, I paid attention. I went 10 years of grade school without missing a day of school.
You never missed a day of school?
No.
What happens when it rained and the road got muddy?
Well, if school was canceled,
oh, okay,
then I would miss. Right. But if school was going on, then I went.
Mm-hmm. Now, your mom seems to me to be the real athlete in the family, because you have two brothers that are good athletes, and your mom is, you know, she must, because I think all good athletes get it from their mother's side as opposed to their father's.
Well, you know, I think both of them would like to bargain for that, that statement. But, you know, I think a little bit of both. My mother was a basketball player back when they played, I think it was six-man basketball or something. She's not that old, but my goodness, six-man basketball. And then my dad, of course, he likes to think that he likes to boast around town that I got my arm from him. He was a pitcher in college at Southern Mississippi and also played football, but it's kind of unusual that he played receiver and all three of his sons played quarterback.
Now, what about your grandma? She has an interesting past, too. Yeah. Meemaw?
Meemaw.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, she knew Al Capone? Meemaw's up here on the dock here.
Yeah, she's listening. I don't know too many people she doesn't know.
Yeah.
But you're right. She has a very unique past and present.
Yeah, okay. Is that right, Meemaw?
I didn't hear that. What did he say?
He said you have a very unique past and present.
That was funny.
To go back for a second, do you remember your first experiences playing football as a kid?
Sure.
Yeah.
I can remember the first game I ever played in, just like it was yesterday.
What happened?
Well, first of all, it was as we call it, jamboree. It was three games in one day.
Yeah.
I was a fifth grader. And you play like a quarter against one team, a quarter against another team, and then a half against the third team. And I had my uniform on, it was funny because my dad said, well, I got to get a haircut first.
Your dad told you had to get a haircut?
No, he had to get a haircut, yeah. And he was taking me to the game. Yeah. He wasn't my coach. Now, if he had been my coach, we'd have been there an hour before. Mm-hmm. So we go and get a I go sit in the barber shop with full uniform on. And he
wait for your dad.
For him to get his crew cut.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't have a watch on, but I knew that the game was supposed to start about 11 o'clock. And it was about 10:30, and we were about 30 minutes away. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting all nervous. You know, I'm nervous enough that I got to play a game because I've never played one before. And here is my dad's falling asleep in the barber chair trying to get a haircut. So finally he gets done. He says, oh, don't worry about it, son. We'll get there. So we pull up in our old pickup truck that had an extension wire held to the passenger door to keep it from flying open. You know, it wouldn't even lock anymore. So I jump out. I run out on the field, and they'd already started playing. I was a split end, and wasn't quarterback. They put me in, like, the first play I think I was in. It was the first or second play. The guy threw one to me. I jumped up and caught it, and I came down on top of the ball and knocked the wind out of me. Now, if you've ever had the wind knocked out of you, you know, you think you're dying.
Oh, yeah, especially the first time.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm crying now because I'm late. Now I'm really crying because now I think I'm dying because I can't breathe. And I jumped up after I started crying. Everyone came out to see if I was okay. You know, they pick you up by your pants, the whole deal. Cheerleaders are looking. And I said, I don't want to play this position anymore. I said, can I play quarterback? So they put me in a quarterback, and we were running the wishbone. And I think I ran three touchdowns in that day. And the last one I ran in, I got the guy. You know, you had your Fruit of the Looms on.
Yeah.
And you just
you
pulled your football.
You weren't wearing a jock strap.
No. You know, fifth grade. And then you pull your pants over them. You had those snap-in pads.
Yeah.
Just snapped in hip, butt, and the other side pad. And the guy tackled me as I went in end zone and just pulled him right down. And I was sitting there in my underwear in the end zone. I do remember.
That was a unique end zone celebration.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I can't do that anymore, though.
Now, when you were growing up and you were living in this house, you had all three of your brothers lived in the same room, right?
Right.
But Did y'all sleep in the same bed? That must have been a little...
No, I had a little single bed. My older and younger brother slept together in a king-size bed.
Well, how did you get the single? I mean, if you think your older brother would have gotten that, how did you rate that?
My two brothers like to snuggle, as they call it. I was never a big snuggler, so I said, look, you guys can snuggle in the big bed. I'll take the single bed.
Now, three guys, too. What about all the laundry and stuff? You guys must have ended up picking up, you know, wearing each other's clothes and stuff. Did you have, like, name tags, like, for your guys?
Well, see, I would always mark my stuff. And Scott and Jeff would never mark theirs. They didn't care. Yeah.
When you marked it, would you write Brett on the back of the...
I'd usually write BF on it.
Yeah.
And Scott and Jeff wouldn't do it. But occasionally I'd see them walking around the house with BF on their underwear. Yeah. Or their T-shirt or shoes, because me and Scott's always worn the same pair of shoes. And, you know, I would get very angry, because we'd all
if
go to...
If somebody else is wearing your underpants?
Yeah. Well, now I'm pretty used to it, because I've bought about 40 pair of underwear, and that way I can...
Would you wear the jockeys or the trunks?
I kind of got the...
You don't have to show us.
I kind of got the half deal, you know, the half underwear, half boxers.
Yeah. What are they called, the halfway...
Joe Boxers or something, something like that. I don't even know.
Well, I can't say I've always wanted to know if Brett Favre was a boxers or briefs kind of guy, but gotta love that Steve had such a curious mind, even though I must admit I am still cracking up that he asked a grown man about his underpants. When we come back, we'll hear about Brett's college and pro experiences, and I promise you, no more underwear talk. Not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. Welcome back to NFL Films' Tales from the Vault. Brett Favre's toughness has always been legendary. His determination to never miss a game ultimately led to 321 consecutive starts, including the playoffs, the most in league history. But for those that don't know, that streak and his toughness are even more impressive when you learn about his near-death experience prior to his senior year in college. It's been written about, but hearing it from the mouth of Brett Favre is chilling.
When you went to college and then you had that automobile accident, how did that happen?
Basically, you probably drove right past it because it's only about 7/10 of a mile from where we're sitting right now.
That sounded like a horrible accident.
Well, it was. I'm very fortunate, but also very unfortunate. That was at a time, once again, back when the road, now it's been redone. Mm-hmm. And at one time it was real gravel and like loose dirt. Mm-hmm. And I was coming home. I was actually coming here. And there's a sharp curve and went around the curve. Probably was going faster than I should have been, but, you know, I'd done that a million times and caught the, like the shoulder of the dirt. You can see coming down this road. If you lose it, you know, you're done. And just lost control and tried to pull it back on the road. And when I did, and went off the other side, flipped three times and hit a pine tree.
The car flipped in the air three times.
Yeah, went down into an embankment.
Sounds like one of those Die Hard crashes that you see in
like
the movies.
The Fall Guy.
Yeah, the Fall Guy.
Yeah, looked like the Fall Guy. Except I came away with a few more injuries than he would. But it was July 14th of 1990, and was going into what I'd hoped to be, you know, like a Heisman Trophy senior season, whether or not
at Southern Miss.
Right. Yeah. You know, a small school. We had a good schedule, playing Alabama, Auburn, Georgia, those type of schools, and was hoping that would propel me into the NFL. So we had a good chance. I came away with 30 inches of intestines being removed, fractured vertebrae in my back, numerous cuts and bruises and other things. But ended up playing on our second game, September 8th.
How many weeks after the accident was that?
Well, I had the surgery August 8th to remove the intestines.
And then you played
4 weeks later against Alabama.
Did the doctor say it was okay for you to do
that? No, they told me I needed to sit out the whole year.
And you played 4 weeks?
4 weeks later. Yeah. Because, they said, well, why don't you just take a redshirt year? Because I hadn't redshirted yet, and just sit out and come back the following year, ready and... probably better than you ever have been. And I said, well, you know, this is supposed to be my year. And I think if I can come back and prove to everyone that if I can play after everything that's happened, then I can play at any time. And they said, well, it won't be done. I mean, you're just in too bad a shape. You know, I'd lost 35 pounds. Mm-hmm. So I proved them wrong and came back and played. And we played Alabama that day and beat them.
Mm-hmm. Then you went on to the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
and you get drafted by the Falcons. Mm-hmm. Jerry Glanville's a coach. Now, I know Jerry Glanville, and I know you pretty well, and you'd think that that'd be a good combination, you know, and it wasn't. What happened? How come that didn't work out?
Well, the way I look at it, the old saying, opposite attracts.
Yeah.
That's true. Me and Mike Holmgren are totally opposite, mm-hmm. but we get along very well. Me and Jerry were too much alike. Mm-hmm. You know, Atlanta wasn't big enough for the two of us. And obviously, he had a lot more power than I had, so I was gone, and he stayed. You know,
how would you describe your lifestyle when you were in Atlanta then, when you were just...
Oh, it was free-spirited, you know, mm-hmm. Having fun, going out every night. I had friends from high school who lived there. My brother was living with me. Yeah. I was 20 years old half the season. Had all this money and a lot of time.
Yeah.
And we went and played golf every day, and we went out at night, and you know, I showed up for meetings and did everything I was asked to do, but there was no interest there. You know, I didn't
from
really
Jerry,
care.
He didn't. He didn't.
Well, no interest from him, and none from me. I mean, I was never really given a chance other than playing a little bit in preseason, and then they brought in Billy Joe Tolliver, and I was never told why he was put in the second string, and I was made third without ever a battle for it. But I think that's the best thing that ever happened to me, was getting a chance to play for Atlanta.
When Jerry Glanville said that Brett Favre was unteachable, that you had a bunch of teachers here that read it and sent a letter to him saying that you were really a good student and that wasn't the right way to describe you?
Absolutely. I had about five or six teachers who wrote letters. I had elementary teachers, junior high teachers, and high school teachers who wrote to him and basically set him straight.
Mm-hmm. All right, going now we're to Green Bay. How would you describe your relationship with Mike?
Well, it started off very rocky and, mm-hmm. and difficult because we were so different. And the way I look at it, and I could be wrong.
You say you're really different. I mean, describe you and describe Mike. Why you say you're that different?
Well, I'm from here. I'm from South Mississippi. Mike's from San Francisco. And most people in the United States, maybe not most people, but have been to San Francisco before they've been to South Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they came to South Mississippi, they'd see a big difference. I mean, everything here is so slow. Mm-hmm. And no one gets in a hurry. There's no traffic. I never saw a taxi cab until I left high school.
Mm-hmm.
We basically eat Cajun food around here. Mm-hmm. It's either fried shrimp or red beans and rice or etouffee.
Po' boys
or shrimp Creole, something like that. You know,
in Jersey, all we have is diners. So you just talk about fried eggs,
right?
And bacon,
you know, you
and
guys.
Hash browns,
that's right. You guys
know.
Jump out of a cab, grab a Philly beef and cheese steak, and then you jump back in the cab and you go off.
That's right.
You know, here we just take our time. We ride into town, eat a nice po' boy, and you drink your Barks root beer.
Yeah.
And that's basically your day. And people here talk real slow, and they have their own unique sayings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how they deal with things. Mm-hmm. I mean, just real slow, and then. Here's Mike, who is basically used to a fast lifestyle. Been in San Francisco and coaching at BYU, winning Super Bowls, coaching Joe Montana, you know, the best quarterback to ever play the game. Then Steve Young, who may be the second best to ever play. And then to go to Green Bay, which obviously was a big change for him, and then have Brett Favre come in, who was just totally unpolished. And to try, you know, I'm sure that's the biggest job he's had yet, was to try to make me into a great quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
And he's done a hell of a job.
What did he try to do? What did he focus on in the beginning?
Well, I think at first he maybe took it a little fast.
Yeah.
You know, and because he was so used to everything being perfect and winning games and winning the Super Bowls that he thought he could come right in and do that.
But what about you? I mean, you obviously were a good student in school. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could pick things up. You'd think that you'd be a quick study.
Well, I was, but, you know, I had to. The third game of the season, I had to play.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an offense that I'm still learning.
Yeah.
And it's been 4 years. And we, basically, when we went in, we tried to do everything at once. And I say we, Mike and the offensive coaches tried to say, okay, here it is. Here's 150 pass plays we're going into this game with. And I thought, God, this is the way it's supposed to be. This is going to be very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Well, eventually, over a couple of years, now we're going with 75. We've actually backed off.
Mm-hmm.
We said, let's learn these first and then go on to these. And in the first couple of months there, it was not like that.
Mm-hmm.
And my head was swimming. And I said, God, maybe I'm just an idiot.
Yeah.
Come to find out that every guy that's ever went through this offense has had that problem. But every guy that's ever went through this offense had a chance to wait. Montana didn't start in his first year. Steve Young definitely didn't start in his first year. But I had to start in our third game. And my head was swimming. I was learning on the run. And that's the most difficult.
Was that the game against the Bengals?
It was a game against the Bengals.
And you won that with, we got, I'm sure you've seen that shot. We got that great shot of you in the winning touchdown.
Right in the corner.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I've seen it a million times. And I played horrible up until that last drive. Mm-hmm. I was fumbling. I had dropped interceptions, everything. And then at the end of the game, Mike called some basic plays, and he kept repeating them, and it worked. And then gradually we started working in things that we could do as a team.
Well, are you the kind of quarterback that likes it when a play breaks down and then you got to be on your own resources to make it work?
Well, I don't want to say I like it, but if that happens, I feel very comfortable in doing it. I'd love to be able to drop back, have a perfect pocket, read for 3 or 4 seconds, make a throw. But that's not going to happen. So I've always prided myself on knowing before I go into a game that there's going to be times where a guy breaks free. You know, as great as our offensive line is, somebody's going to break free. The guys across them are pretty good. So what do you do next? Mm-hmm. You know, I don't look at it as, okay, I'm going to go into this game. Everything's going to be perfect. If I get rushed, I'll just throw it away. You make most of your big plays when you leave the pocket.
Now, you don't have to be modest on this one. You think you have a strong arm?
Yeah, I do. Mm-hmm. You know, I've worked... Ever since I was a little kid, I've worked on throwing it as far as anyone else. And that's
hard or as far?
As far, which enabled me to throw, you know, in the sixth grade, if I could throw 50 yards, that meant I could throw 30 pretty hard. And then it just gradually got, you know, I don't work, when I try to make my arm strong, I don't take 30-yard passes and just throw as hard as I can. I go about 70 yards and try to throw it.
70 yards?
70 yards and just throw it as many times as I can until my arm is about to fall off.
Do you ever have the criticism thrown at you that you throw the ball too hard?
At one point, but not anymore. I always knew I could throw a touch ball, but...
A touch ball is... Explain that. What do you mean? Like a little screen pass?
You throw a football to any person in the world, and when they throw it back to you, they probably throw it hard. Mm-hmm. But a touch pass is when a guy's 20, 15, 10 yards away, and you're able to just... lob it in there perfect.
It's like throwing a dart, sort of?
No, a dart is more of a, you know... Like that? Right.
Darts is probably a big game around here. I shouldn't have said that. You're probably pretty good at that. See,
not really.
Yeah.
Because I like to drill it, you know, and then you can't pull the darts out of the board. But a touch pass, is hard to do. You know, if a guy's running away from you and there's a guy guarding him, but he's 2 yards behind him, obviously you can't drill it because you'll hit the defender, but you got to be able to touch it in like a rainbow.
Yeah.
And it is a hard pass to make, but I feel that I can throw it as well as anyone. But if someone sees me throw one as hard as I possibly can, they think that kid's got no touch. Mm-hmm. You know, so.
But you got an interesting motion because you really like come right over the top like that. Is that something that came naturally to you?
Or? It just came natural. And God, you know, I'm lucky that it did because it's one of the best things that's ever happened to me was my release because it's a quick release, it's short, and it's snappy, but also, you know, there's a lot of velocity behind it.
Now, playing quarterback, do you think it's better to have a strong arm or to be able to make quick decisions?
I think quick decisions.
Yeah.
Because almost every play is a quick decision. You know, if you have a strong arm but you're 2 seconds late, you can forget it. Mm-hmm. You know, nowadays the guys are so good. You know, some of your best athletes are cornerbacks nowadays. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these guys are getting better and better each year. And having a strong arm just doesn't cut it anymore. You have to have a lot of timing and, like you said, quick decisions. You got to know before your guy and the defender knows where you're going.
But as having a strong arm as you do, that can work against you, can't it? Because you can get overconfident and just figure, the guy's open, and you can force it.
Right. It's kind of like baseball. You take a pitcher who can throw 95. He has no junk. You know, he can't throw a good curveball, not a good changeup, but he throws the ball so hard he thinks he can overpower every guy who steps to the plate. So he just drills a fastball in there. Eventually, some guy's going to knock it out of the park.
Now, if we were going to look at all the interceptions that you've thrown in the last 3 years, what do you think would be the cause of most of them? Either you made a bad read, your receiver made a bad read, or maybe you decided to force the ball in.
Forcing.
This might be the first plane ever to fly over Kill, Mississippi, right?
I
haven't heard a sound, right?
Could be. They may have heard that Steve Sable is in town and they're trying to get, you know, that could be hard copy. But you're right. They don't fly around too often.
But go ahead. Continue what we were talking about.
it's almost every interception I've ever thrown has been forced. Mm-hmm. And that's no one to blame but myself. And I can almost tell you the play every time. You know, it's
one of those things, like, the minute you let it go, you say, oh, no.
And they're mostly all down the middle. Very rarely do you see some of my balls being picked off on the outside by a cornerback, mm-hmm. like a throw that's behind or late. Mm-hmm. Usually it's a throw that's been lobbed through the middle. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, once again, that touch pass, which probably was an accurate pass, but you always hear you never hang the ball up in the middle mm-hmm. because there's always someone roaming around. Mm-hmm.
You know what John Brody used to play quarterback for the 49ers, mm-hmm. used to call that pass a St. Luke's pass, when it's hanging up over the middle, because whoever's going to catch it is going to end up in the hospital because you're going to, you know,
right,
you're
going to get your guy killed or you're going to throw an interception. Mm-hmm. Unless you just, it's a perfect throw and it's on time. Mm-hmm. And that's hard to do over the middle.
Is that the toughest pass for you to throw?
It is. I like that pass because, you know, it's kind of the way I've grown up. I like to do, you know, when I was playing touch football growing up and we'd be out in the yard playing, it'd be 10 guys wide open. Mm-hmm. But I'd always throw the guy who was covered because that was the hard one to do. Yeah. And then when you complete it, everyone would go, "Woo, that's pretty good." Yeah. And that's kind of got me in trouble today. You know, a guy looks kind of wide open down the middle, but I know it's a tough pass. I'll try to make it. Mm-hmm. And I just got to learn that throwing down the middle is probably the worst place to throw.
Ultimately, Favre ended up with a much more ignominious record than his consecutive game streak. Most interceptions thrown in NFL history with 336. So this reminds me of a conversation I had with Brett just a few years ago. We were talking about the quarterback he thinks most resembles him in the game today, and it's Patrick Mahomes. Of course, both Favre and Mahomes, coached by Andy Reid. So Favre had said to Reid, "It's got to be a lot easier coaching Patrick Mahomes than it is me." And Reid said, "No." So Favre says, "Andy, you're just being too kind. He never throws interceptions. I mean, what fun is that? As a coach, don't you want a little stress every once in a while?" As Favre said, he gave Andy plenty. Well, when we come back, Steve hits Brett with a couple of out-of-left-field questions that you have to hear to believe. Brett Favre has always been a natural storyteller. In fact, over the years, any time that we would sit with him in a television production meeting or even in a casual setting, he would start to spin a yarn, as he might say. You know, he'd start talking about something and you'd wonder how we'd even gotten on this subject. And of course, oftentimes, it would be some crazy story about his childhood. So when you hear these next two stories, this was not unusual for Brett.
Now, your mom was showing me around the house earlier, and there are a lot of these candles around here. What was that for? All these different, like, white candles. It looked like a voodoo kind of shrine or something. Do you know?
My goodness, I don't know.
Yeah, well, your mom said something that a psychic...
I don't know if mom still does that, but a couple of years ago, the psychic told me, it was right when I was throwing these 24 interceptions type thing, and she said, "Next year, you're going to have a great season." This was going into my third year. She goes, "But you got to light candles all week long." Yeah. So, of course, people would ride by my house and they had smoke coming out of windows and chimneys and all this stuff. But I told my mom about it, and a couple other friends knew about it. So everyone was lighting candles. Mm-hmm. Sure enough, I threw 33 touchdowns and like 17 interceptions, and you know, we went to the playoffs, won the first round. Well, then she told me, mid-season that year, that this is not going to be your best year, that next year is going to be even better.
The psychic said that?
Yeah, and she said, just continue lighting candles and believe and all this stuff that you're going to do it, which I've always done, but I never lit candles before. So, you know, I lit some more candles, and after a while, I kind of quit doing a little bit. I kind of got, you know, a little embarrassed. You know, guys would come over, and, you know, like, you know, I had a harem going. but sure enough, last year was MVP season, and... So maybe, you know, mom and everyone else is still doing it.
All right, I want to ask you a real serious question. You look back at your life and there's time you had that accident and you've been in an operating table and you've had seizures and you've been near death. Mm-hmm. If you had died and you hadn't had the opportunity to communicate, to let your last words with somebody, what would you regret not having told someone? If you'd have died in that car accident or on that, when you had your knee operated on, is there something that you would have regretted not communicating to someone then, if you'd have died right there?
I don't know. I mean, that's a tough question.
I know. I told you it was a tough question. You know?
You didn't tell me coming in you was going to ask me something like that. I don't know. Yeah. You know, I've never thought about it that way. You know, I guess I just want people to know, you know, how hard it is to play the sport I do, and how hard it's taken me to get here, and that I, you know, I am a good person, and a lot of people that I went to high school with, a lot of people that I grew up with around here, I don't see much anymore. Uh-huh. And I think they probably would assume that, you know, Brett's stuck up, and uh-huh. now that he makes money, you know, he's too good for us and all uh-huh. that, you know, which is totally false. You know, I think if anything, people have changed around me uh-huh. because they assume too much. I wish it wasn't that way, but I bet a lot of celebrities and athletes could relate to that uh-huh. because we're basically the same person. If anything, a little more humble, a little more modest, and fortunate. You know, I'm very fortunate because I grew up just like everyone else around here, and I just want people to know that and treat me as such and not treat me any different. And I know that's hard for people to do, but, you know, if anything, one thing I've tried to do is give back to people, you know, whether it's here in Mississippi, whether it's in Green Bay or United States in general. I try to do a lot of things for other people, family members, mm-hmm. friends. And a lot of that goes unnoticed. You know, a lot of the negative things that we do as athletes and celebrities makes a paper, and that's mm-hmm. the big deal. And that's the unfortunate thing about what we do.
Why is it so important to you to be so tough, to be able throw up blood against the Steelers and keep playing, play on an ankle against the Bears, you can hardly walk? I mean, is that part of being a quarterback, something that people don't talk about? We're talking about how you make quick decisions, mm-hmm. how to have a strong arm. But what about the toughness? That seems to be so important to you.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it's part of being a quarterback, although nowadays there are more tough quarterbacks than several years back. We could name a bunch. But it's just part of my mentality and how I grew up. I wasn't able to be hurt unless I really was hurt. You know, you get the wind knocked out of you. My dad's over there screaming at me, get up. Mm-hmm. You know, I played baseball for him in summer league ball when I was 18 and got hit, you know, in the groin area, in the mm-hmm. midsection. And it basically knocked me down at shortstop. And if you've ever been hit there, you know what it feels like. Yeah. My dad's screaming from the dugout, throw the damn ball. So I had to throw it before I laid down and started throwing up on shortstop. I couldn't lay there, you know, like other guys. And then eventually, I didn't want to. There was one point where I wanted to get the attention and I wanted to lay down and have everyone look at you and wonder, God, is he okay? When you got up, they clap for you. You know, and
Terry Bradshaw could really do that.
Oh, yeah, he could play it up bigger than anyone. But, you know, I don't like to do that. There was one point where I did because I think my team needs me too much and I want to be out there.
We talked to a lot of great players. I think we just were talking to Walter Payton. And he was saying there's a little voice inside him that says, you got to do better. You got to do better. I asked Emmitt Smith the same question about, do you mm-hmm. have a little voice inside of you? And he says, yeah, it's make it happen. Make it happen. Do you have some little, like a conscience or like a little thing on your shoulder?
Kind of like Walter Payton, you can do better. You know, as well as I played last year, we didn't win the Super Bowl. So there's some room for improvement.
Okay, that's it.
A little over 6 months after his interview with Steve, Brett won his first and only Super Bowl, beating the Patriots in New Orleans, about 2 hours from where this interview took place. Over the years, Favre has done many an interview with NFL Films, but nothing will top Steve and Brett sitting on the dock of the Rotten Bayou, talking family and football. Now, next week, we'll hear from one of Brett's top rivals in the 90s, another Hall of Fame quarterback, the Cowboys' Troy Aikman. Thanks for taking this trip with me into the NFL Films vault. Hope you'll join us again next week. I'm Andrea Kramer.